You're listening to the Binge Media Podcast Network on bingemedia.net. And now, the Binge Aftertaste.
Welcome to this review of Dunkirk, part of the Binge Movie Aftertaste Christopher Nolan retrospective.
Tide's turning now. How can you tell? The body's come back.
Join Garrett.
A bloody frog! A cowardly little queue-jumping frog.
Matt.
He's a fucking Jerry.
And Jack.
He doesn't speak English. If he does, it's with an accent thicker than sauerkraut sauce.
As they go through the praised British filmmaker's entire resume, one movie at a time, all leading up to a review of his highly anticipated latest film, Tenet.
He's coming back round!
Is Nolan's fandom an act of overpraise?
Well done.
All we did is survive.
That's enough.
Does his deconstruction of metaphysical themes in his work constitute a positive trait?
I knew he'd see us through.
Will Matt still be standing when this retrospective is over?
Better him than me.
Find out the answers to these questions and many more, all coming up courtesy of Binge Media.
You can practically see it from here.
What?
Home.
Dunkirk, released July 21st, 2017. Budget was $150 million. Box office, $526.9 million. And this is directed by Christopher Nolan. Here we are, guys. It is the movie he followed Interstellar with, and he does it with a war movie. Now, Matt, in our time together, we've done this podcast plenty of years now. Is this our first war movie?
It's technically our first war movie, although it's not the first war we've fought over these airwaves.
Well, hold on a second. Haven't you guys done... Well, I can't remember now. Have you done Freddy versus Jason? Because there could be an argument to be made.
All right. Just second saying. War movie. You're okay, right.
Fine. I think for Sean S. Cunningham, that was his Vietnam. yeah, because like even fucking Star Wars, I wasn't on those shows, so I can't even cheat on that, so... Yeah, this is our first war movie in the 5 years we've been doing this, and never thought it would have come from Christopher Nolan, of all people, and this movie in particular cost me $50, not just the ticket price, that's part of it. I had a bet going that when the trailer came out, and I said, oh, Nolan's going to make a three-hour bloated juggernaut, then my buddy goes, did you check the runtime? I go, no. He goes, I bet you $50, I'm going to check it. That's shorter than 2.5 hours. I said, fine, I'll take that. And then he goes, 105 minutes. I go, you're out of your fucking mind. There's no way Christopher Nolan made a movie under 2.5 hours. Sure enough, I checked 12 different websites, and it's going to be a mistake or something. Sure enough, I was like, wow, I guess someone held Nolan at gunpoint saying, do what you want, but you got to keep it under 2.5 hours. I didn't think it was possible with four straight movies that clocked in at 2.5 or more.
Plus. Boy, you do have a gambling problem, don't you? You bet that it wasn't over 2.5 hours.
Well, you got to have action. I mean, life's not worth living without a little fucking skin in the game.
You know the odds I would have had on that? He was riding a hot streak. Like, of course I'm going to take that bet.
When it comes to war films, are you guys fans of them?
This is going to give me so much hate. I'm a film purist in certain ways. My favorite war films, I would say, are pre-1980. I love Pass of Glory, speaking of Kubrick. Mm-hmm. All Quiet on the Western Front, I really like. Guns of Navarone, I'm a huge fan of. But the big ones, I don't like Saving Private Ryan at all. I recognize why so many people like it, but war movies are not my go-to.
You know, I'm a little bit like Matt in the sense that I'm not really seeking war movies out as a genre, but I mean, some of the best movies I've ever seen are war films. I guess Schindler's List is in that bucket, right? I mean, it's gotta be. Mm-hmm. Bridge on the River Kwai, I fucking love. I do love Saving Private Ryan. Stalag 17 was one of my granddad's favorites. My granddad was a World War II vet, and he was actually on a destroyer and a submarine. He actually got two Purple Hearts. And his two favorite war movies which was always interesting to me, were Das Boot, always the unedited full director's cut Das Boot, and Stalag 17. Those were always the two. And I definitely, you know, he showed me a lot of movies when I was younger. I've talked about it on podcasts before, but he's kind of where I get a lot of my movie love from. Mm. Stalag 17 definitely is always fucking love that movie. So I guess I don't seek them out exclusively because they're war movies. I just kind of, I want to see good movies. There happen to be a bunch of them that are war movies. That's fine, but I'm not exclusively like a fan of the genre, I guess is what I'd say.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And Garrett, I guess if you want to get specific, the last Harry Potter movie I would count as a war film.
Well, I guess you could in many ways. Would Raiders of the Lost Ark count? Because that's my... No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, he's beating the fuck out of Nazis, so...
Yeah, it's one of those things because, like, you know, do you count The Great Escape as a quote-unquote war movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You kind of wrestle that. It's in that Great Escape territory.
And then, of course, the classic, you know, War for the Planet of the Apes. I mean, come on now.
1941. You know, when it comes to war films, I grew up on them. My father was more of a fan of them than I was. But the two of us, we used to watch all of Jack's favorite director, Oliver Stone's films. We used to watch those a lot.
Woof.
Platoon, Born on the 4th of July. But I'm back and forth like you guys. I'm not a huge fan of Saving Private Ryan, save that first 15 minutes or so. The ones I like are the little known ones, like the one that Clint Eastwood did where it was the Chinese and the Japanese.
Letters from Iwo Jima.
Yes, I thought that was fantastic. Those are the ones I kind of like. So when I heard that Christopher Nolan, of all people, this guy who does these, as Jack pointed out last podcast, the existential films, you know, these movies where we're questioning whether God exists or not, and he's going to be doing a war film, that kind of gathered my interest a little bit. So you combine my kind of lack of interest in war films with a guy I've been a back and forth big fan of, Christopher Nolan, I'm pretty interested. Jack, did you think Nolan could handle a subject matter like this?
Yeah, I mean, I was completely in on this movie. When I heard about it after Interstellar, it sounded really interesting. I didn't know a whole lot about the Dunkirk incident.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously we're American, but in the UK, this is very well known. Like, it's part of their history. The Dunkirk spirit is spoken of. It's part of the fabric of being British, really, is the incident at Dunkirk. And for me, before this movie, I had some awareness that something happened. I had no idea what the context was. But the fact that Nolan was doing it, I'm a fan of the guy. I'm a director guy. Alex and I were just talking about this on another podcast. I don't really fucking care about actors that much. I recognize when actors are great. But I'm paying attention to directors and writing. That's always been what I've attacked in terms of how I digest film, right? Like, or go and find similar stuff to what I already have seen and like. So to a certain degree, whatever Nolan's making, I'm willing to go on that ride. I like his aesthetic and his style. So him bringing that to a war movie, for me, there's a high probability it's going to work. So I was definitely excited and I was intrigued. Yeah, I was all in on this before it was coming out.
Interesting. Matt, how much did you know of the Dunkirk story before actually seeing this movie?
Name only, to be perfectly honest. Despite my possession of a history degree, one of my degrees, it was predicated on American history largely. But my only real exposure to it outside of this, there was the Winston Churchill movie. There's a couple of them. There was one with Brian Cox. There was one with Brendan Gleeson, and both of those touch on it a bit because they were instrumental in his, I guess, ascension to being a popular figure in the UK as prime minister until they ran him out of town. So that was really my only perspective on it. I didn't know the details. I didn't know what happened, what transpired, but the idea of Nolan doing this intrigued me, especially hearing a lot of the comments that he was making going into the movie. Like, he mentioned that there was seldom dialogue. He wanted to make a movie that was predicated on the cinematography, the music. So definitely all those components were in getting me engaged, but at the same time, I did not care for any of the last three films he had done.
Yeah.
To varying degrees. I'm not gonna get back on that Inception. I'm still getting shit for that review. Love you, Chad, but get over it, man.
Fucking Vikings fans, you know?
Yeah, but yeah, I didn't like his last three movies, but this felt like a true passion project without coming across as pretentious the way that Interstellar stuck me, because Interstellar was very existential and very much about what about essentially like where is humanity's place going to be in the future. Here it's a historical piece, which is the first one he's done, like true real to life history, getting away from the sci-fi and guys in masks beating the shit out of the mentally ill. So I was excited for this, not gonna lie.
As far as what I knew, look, my degrees are in English and journalism, okay? So I didn't know too much about it. The only things I knew the Churchill speech, which I think is a pretty famous speech, and I knew that Dunkirk was a huge turning point in the war as far as Brits go. Let's not forget, Jack, you pointed it out, we're Americans here. According to us, nothing good happened until we got involved, right? Nothing real significant happened before we got involved.
Damn right.
You know? So, like, I knew this was a turning point for them as a country and for the war period before we got involved. So,
USA had to save the day.
Well, there's another aspect of that that's kind of important to point out, too. Nolan's British. So this is it has to be a very personal story for him. I mean, just from a perspective of like national pride, it's an element that I don't know is present in his other movies. Just something that, granted, he didn't live through this or whatever, but it feels closer to something that he, I don't know, he cares about or is proud of. So it's sort of a different feel than the other movies.
Yeah, in the mid-90s, him and Emma Thomas, his wife, they took the exact route that these soldiers took. And he said that it struck him so hard that he knew he was going to make a movie based off it. And, it interested me when I heard that he was doing this story. Much like you, Jack, how would he approach this? Would he dramatize real historical figures? Would we see physical representations of them? Would he take the James Cameron approach and just make every character here up? Mm-hmm. He originally wanted to just improv it, just have actors improv the entire thing. And his wife was the one who convinced him, No, you got to write the script. You got to take it from a different angle. That was his approach. It was a very big passion project for him, as you said, Matt. And so, yeah, I walked in. I was very curious to see this. I saw this opening weekend, as I've seen all Nolan films, and I was all set for it. But that being said, I only saw it once before. I watched it twice for this particular podcast. Did you guys go opening weekend to this?
Oh, yeah. Opening night IMAX. Had to. I actually saw this opening night, and then the same weekend I took my dad, I think maybe that Sunday we went back to the theater, and then a week or two later I actually took my uncle. So I think I saw this three times in the IMAX.
Matt?
It was a Friday night showing. Yeah, it would have been probably the first weekend. I can't imagine I waited a week.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we start things off not with the overbearing horns of Hans Zimmer, but with a set of subtitles which sets up the film. They say that the enemy have driven the French and the British armies to sea, and they await their fate in Dunkirk. So Nolan is putting us right in the middle of war right off the bat. We're not seeing any strategizing or anything. We're just right in the middle of it. Jack, did you like that approach?
Yeah, I like the opening. I think it's a good opening.
Yeah, I agree, because we're seeing shots of papers, warnings from the enemy fall from what seems like the sky. And we meet Tommy, who is trying desperately to get a drink of water. And then the one scene that made me jump happens. As we've talked about a lot in this retrospective, boys, sound is ultra important in Nolan's films. And here, as people are wandering the streets, bullets hit the speakers, and my God, is it jarring.
God, yeah, the other thing, Garrett, great way to open this. That you might want to mention before we move on is that, so those papers that fall, one of the things that's really interesting about this movie for me is that the visual storytelling, and on those papers, it's a map, and it's showing you are here, you're surrounded. Yeah. So you know right off the hop that everybody's under siege. And then 30 seconds later, you're right, that bullet just like rips through the audio track and you're like, holy shit.
God, it's crazy.
I think this starts a trend in the movie overall for me, in that it subverts a lot of my expectations. I thought this was going to open with bombastic Hans Zimmer music, just cataclysm of gunfire and explosions. But nope, starts off very somber, very quiet, and purposefully so. Once the bullets start flying, it is intentionally jarring. And unlike Interstellar, I think the sound mixing in this movie is far superior than it was in Interstellar. Like, between the problems I have with Bane and some of the drowning sound effects in Interstellar, I think the technicals in this opening are much tighter than they've been in certainly the last couple of movies.
Yeah, this was turning into Transformers a bit for you, Matt. These last three podcasts have been really tough on you, and so right away you feel like you're in better hands here. This is a different Nolan, and you're liking where you're at right now.
Yeah, we're 5 minutes into the movie, so I can't.
Yeah,
I'm not going to turn on it just yet, or will I? But as far as doing something different, I'm like, all right, he's got me invested.
So So Tommy's yelling that he's English, and the soldiers, which end up being French soldiers, they allow him to awkwardly hop over the barricade. Now, Nolan makes a choice here that I really want to ask you guys about. In other war films, we see the enemy strategizing or at least approach where they are going to shoot. Barring a few shots of planes and a blurry shot at the end of this film, we never really see the enemy in this movie.
Yeah,
how do you guys like that approach?
One of my favorite things about it. I think it makes it way... Well, I think it adds a certain tension that you might not get if you saw who was fighting them. At least on the first watch, it feels like they literally could be anywhere. So I really like the way that, especially in an IMAX theater, you know, with the sound really blaring and everything, it kept me on edge when I was watching it.
It's one of my favorite aspects of the movie because it's literally, they're out of sight, but they're not out of mind. They could come out of nowhere at any time. And because of that, you're always on edge. And there's this unshaking sense of dread that something bad's going to happen with any of these characters. Because literally, the opening text, they are described as the enemy. He doesn't call them Nazis. He doesn't call them Germans. And also, I think it's Nolan doing something inventive because this is a war film that is PG-13. That's pretty rare nowadays. A lot of the major ones around this time, like Hacksaw Ridge, and what was that Brad Pitt one with the tank?
Oh, Fury.
Fury. You know, those are some of the most visceral war movies I've ever seen. They might as well be splatterpunk movies. Here, it's effective without being overtly violent. I don't think he could have gone the Saving Private Ryan route, especially with World War II, because it's been done, so Nolan takes an entirely different approach where the enemies are faceless and you can't see them coming, but you also don't need to see the horrors of war because oftentimes the psychological trauma is more provocative than the physical effects of a bullet entering your body.
Yeah, the exception of one part where a guy calls the enemies Jerrys. You're right. There's no mention of Germans, anything in this movie at all. I think there's a scene later where it doesn't work for me, this approach. But here, and the majority of the film, I think it's really, really well done. And effective, by the way. This is also the only scene where we see Tommy use a gun, by the way. As it happens, the gun just jams on him anyway, and he ends up throwing it away. Another good approach, I think, to this movie. Just have this... I mean, I'm guessing that this guy's the main protagonist. I don't know. Jack, do you think this guy's the main protagonist?
Yeah. I mean, the movie's following him for the most part. It's trying to put the audience in his shoes, I think, so...
For the most part, yeah. But all that being said, I want to say one thing about this movie that was incredibly frustrating for me. Starting with Tommy, this movie's just full of anonymous brunette white guys. It took me going to Wiki, actually, after viewing the film, to distinguish who was who. And I once again found myself struggling to care about anyone in a Nolan film. Did this aspect of the movie bother you guys? The fact that they were anonymous and you couldn't really follow who was who? Was that a problem for you guys, too, or is it just me?
I can't believe I'm saying this, but no. And I've been very critical of Nolan's characterizations, especially in Inception. Here it works for me because this is the only war movie I can think of where there's never that scene where it's the characters talking about their lives before the war or what they're going to do after the war ends. They're going to get married and, you know, all that other stuff. Nolan purposely keeps it ambiguous. And I think that works for this movie in a way it doesn't work for Inception because this is a movie that's about how characters respond to an event and a story, not necessarily how the story makes these characters act. Conventional storytelling. He's doing something different, and I appreciate it. And it helps also that this main actor, I have never seen him before in anything. So much like Guy Pearce in Memento, having a certain amount of anonymity is beneficial to the movie for me.
I think there's also something interesting. Matt, you pretty much said this, but the way that I always describe this to people is I think of this movie in the same way that I think of Red State. I like Red State a lot. And the thing that I like about Red State is that it's one of the few movies where the situation is the main character. There's no like central character that carries you through Red State. I think that's probably why a lot of people have problems with it. But it goes from three distinct sections of movie. It kind of flows from one to the other to the other and follows this weird Westboro Baptist Church situation unfold. This movie, the way that it makes you experience Dunkirk from three different perspectives and how they experience Dunkirk in time is fascinating to me. I think that there is a certain level of, yeah, a lot of brown-haired white guys, right? But I think that it's on purpose. I mean, what he's trying to do is he's trying to say, like, these are metaphors for the real people who were there. You know, I'm not going to tell the real story or follow a real person, but the sort of like noble, faceless minority who were able to survive this ordeal. It's a movie where the pieces are more important than the detail of who the people are. I really like that about it.
Yeah, you just hit on something I was just about ready to talk about. We see that this is the mole portion of the film. Now, the movie is split up into three portions, sea, air, and mole. It took me a while to realize why they call the land portion of the movie the mole portion, and we'll get to that later. But, Jack, we kind of heard how you feel about it. Matt, how do you feel about the way Nolan structures this thing into three different sections?
Initially, I was put off because I thought, oh, God, here comes the highbrow elitist bullshit that I've kind of detested in certain aspects, but it's him doing something outside of the confines of a typical war movie. And I think that's especially important for World War II, because between, God, you could count until the day you die how many World War II movies there are. And that includes the more fantastical stuff like Captain America or Raiders of the Lost Ark. They're always, you know, from the land perspective, or it's mission driven. There's a very clear objective. He gets to do that with the, of the three, the air portion is the one that has a clearly defined goal. Whereas one is purely about rescue, one's purely about survival. So I think Nolan is playing with a lot of different resources to prevent burnout, I guess, from audience expectations.
One thing I'm going to once again compliment in this podcast is the Hans Zimmer score. It's not the typical Nolan score that he does. You know, in fact, there are times when it actually feels industrial. It feels like there are things just in the soundtrack that are happening around us that he puts in the score himself. For example, Nolan recorded his watch one time ticking, and he gave it to Zimmer and said, do something with this, which is why you hear the hands ticking. Matt, you yourself have been the one of the three of us has been more critical of Zimmer's scores. How'd you feel about this one?
I don't love it, but I don't find it as obtrusive as I have for the last couple of movies. I think here it works much better. But there's a couple moments where he just can't get away from the bombast. And I know it's a personal thing. I'm never going to get over it. So it's a gripe that I'm just never going to stop being so defensive against.
I actually think this might be my favorite Nolan score so far.
I'm with you. As much as I love the Rises score and the Inception score, well, the Inception score might overtake it, but that might be the only one for me that I find better than this one. This score is phenomenal to me. It builds and builds, and at the end, it just climaxes into a perfect ending for me.
Yeah, I just think it's the most... I like his other scores a lot. I mean, we've talked about them. I love the Batman themes that Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard made, and there's great stuff in Inception. There's more stuff we'll probably talk about on the next show. But this to me is just, it's propulsive. It keeps me in the movie. It made my fucking adrenaline just rise. I loved it.
We see Tommy meet Gibson, who offers him his water as he is burying a body in the sand. Tommy joins a group of soldiers, and it is here where we see the subtitle, The Mole, 1 week. So not only is it split up into three portions as far as where we are, but it's also when we are too. This is 1 week. We're going to see an hour. We're going to see a day. So again, just very well structured, I thought. Planes approach from overhead, and I'm going to bring up something here, boys. I think that Kubrick is one of Nolan's heroes. Did anyone else get a real Terrence Malick vibe from this movie, where the occasional dialogue doesn't really mean much, but it's the audio and visual cues that you need to follow in order to follow this story? That was who I thought of. Jack, are you with me on that?
Well, what interesting timing, seeing as we just released the Badlands movie.
I saw
artwork.
That, yeah.
I guess a little bit. I don't think of Malick. It's an interesting connection. I feel like with Malick, the dialogue doesn't always mean as much, but it does mean something. Whereas here, it's literally just the only dialogue that exists is a utility of, oh, what's wrong with him? Oh, you know, get off the boat. It's very, like, tactile, telling someone to do something or telling them what just happened kind of deal. Whereas Malick, it's like somebody will be droning on about, I saw a flower, and then it'll, you know, triple cut and fade into somebody else talking about their childhood or something. There's just metaphorical shit going on in Malick's stuff that I didn't think of here, but that's just me.
I try to avoid thinking about Terrence Malick 24/7, to be perfectly honest, because I can't stand him. The only similarity I can draw is that they're both, in certain degrees, Malick much more so. There is a certain amount of stream of consciousness to their storytelling where more so a Thin Red Line. There's stuff that just feels like it just came off on a whim. Here, I can see that to a minor extent with the way it kind of intercuts, because there are some characters in here that I think are window dressing and the movie could function without them, but because they're there, Nolan feels like, all right, I have to find something to do. Yeah, that's really the only Terrence Malick allegory that I can make.
I love the shot of Tommy on the ground as the sand just encompasses him with each bomb that's dropped. Just a fantastic shot. We then see the subtitle, The Sea, one day, as we meet Peter and the teenage boat hand George and Peter's dad, Dawson. Now, Dawson's played by Mark Rylance, who has become a Spielberg favorite as of late, and perhaps more well-known for taking the Oscar from Sylvester Stallone as he was in Spielberg's Bridge of Spies. How do you guys like Rylance?
I like him. I think he's good. He's not doing a lot, but I think he's fine.
Completely with you. I like Mark Rylance in the majority of things. I know I'm kind of in the minority in that. I even liked him as the voice in the BFG, honestly. But I'm with you. I think he does a pretty good job here.
I like Rylance in general. I was one of the few people that was not angry that he beat Stallone, because I thought it was a very good performance. But I guess he is to Spielberg now what Michael Caine is to Nolan, where he's just going to be in all of his movies because he enjoys working with them. I think they're very similar, because they both always exude a certain amount of warmth and empathy, which is perfect for this movie, and to put him in on the boat, because that's all about optimism and, you know, trying to do the right thing. In a way, it does feel like, okay, Caine finally said, damn it, Chris, I need some time off. And that's why he's not in this movie.
Well, he's in it. Well, we'll talk about it. He's here.
Is he?
Kind of.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about it here in a little bit. We learn that the Navy has requisitioned the boat and that they need to load up the boat with life jackets. This is Rylance's character talking about his boat. We then see the subtitle, The Air, 1 hour, and we meet the fleet up there, one of which is Farrier, played by Tom Hardy. And this is where Michael Caine shows up. He is the voice in this plane.
Oh, no, no kidding.
You didn't realize that, huh, Matt?
No, part of it is that I was laughing because I have the intellectual capacity of a 12-year-old at times, because I'm like, really? Tom Hardy's in a fucking mask again during
Christopher Nolan
movie where his audio is all muffed up.
I thought the same thing.
You gotta cover that sexy man's face, really?
Now I'm going to go ahead and say, I feel all this stuff in the air. It's the most boring part of the movie for me. I did not like any of this stuff in the air.
Ooh, that's interesting. See, now for me, that was some of my favorite stuff, because I remember really specifically being in the IMAX theater. And that just feeling like I was on a ride. Like, it was just, oh, so everything looked great. All that was IMAX footage. And again, the sound design, I really love that stuff.
Of the three, it's my least favorite component, but I don't hate it. It's not one of those things where I would axe it completely. But at the same time, I don't find it as riveting, because so often in those scenes, it just feels like an excuse for some aerial photography. But I think it serves its purpose.
We see Tommy and Gibson. They come up with a plan to stretcher a body onto a hospital boat in order to get on. And this scene of them with the stretcher, this is a scene that they were showing on IMAX screens months before the movie came out. In fact, Jack, I think I remember you talking about this on a BingeCast.
Yeah, I think I saw this
back then. I still find this to be a very tense and effective scene as the camera just gets lower and lower and they get rickety and then they jump on those boards. I'm on edge the entire time. How'd you guys like this scene?
It's good stuff. Yeah, I like this. I like that we're following the situation. Like,
yeah,
we're not really cutting away from these guys. This one guy in particular, but like, yeah, I like how it's unfolding.
Yeah, I like how everything you see with this guy, he and you as the audience member, you are literally prisoner of the moment.
Something I didn't think about until the second time I watched this is the ironic thing is this guy they stretch on this boat, he ends up dying in the explosion. So, it's crazy to think about. So George hops onto Dawson's boat as they take off. Meanwhile, the head of Farrier's team is shot down, and it would seem that Farrier assumes the role of leader in his absence. Matt, you said Tom Hardy. Did you like him in this, even though he was in a mask the entire time? Did you think this was a role that he was needed in? I mean, it's kind of a small role for him, isn't it?
It's small, but I think he makes it work. But by the same token, it's one of those roles to where he could have done strictly ADR work and just not sat in the cockpit. You could have had someone else. And it's kind of unfortunate that they don't linger on his face as long as they should, because if you see in The Dark Knight Rises, he does so much with just his eyes, and he has to because he's required to because he's wearing a fucking mask. Here, you should let him do that again, but with so many intercuts when they're in the air, he really doesn't get to be as expressive as he was in that.
I'm good with the performance. I don't really have a problem with him.
I've honestly never disliked Tom Hardy in anything. So
anything, huh? You liked him in what was that dumb movie he did with Reese Witherspoon? What was the name of that stupid movie?
Oh, This Means War.
Yeah, This Means War. You liked him in that, huh? He was good in that.
Yeah, I thought he was fine in that. I thought he was. It's him and Chris Pine. My gay flag was up, you know, 100%.
Hey-o.
Beautiful. Alex and Gibson, they get kicked off the hospital ship and they hop aboard a destroyer. We then meet Kenneth Branagh's character of Bolton, who learns that the perimeter is shrinking by the hour and that they are being ordered to get 45,000 troops and that they have 400,000 troops to evacuate. Kenneth Branagh, you know, I feel like he kind of took the Michael Caine role in this, where he's kind of the one espousing the exposition. I like seeing Kenneth Branagh in this. Matt, you and I, we covered Branagh in the Harry Potter series. How'd you like him in this?
I was surprised to see him because he's kind of been taking a back seat in front of the camera. I think before this, the only other thing I had seen him in within the last decade was My Weekend with Marilyn. He hasn't made as many movies as he did in his heyday, but I like seeing him. But then again, I like seeing Branagh pretty much in anything. I think he's a constant professional. He commands authority. And, you know, his limited amount of screen time, I buy him as a commanding officer, absolutely.
Yeah, I like him. I think he's a good addition. He adds the same thing Michael Caine does, you're right. It's like an air of credibility.
Dawson stops and picks up a stranded soldier, played by Cillian Murphy. And I must say, this is my favorite portion of the movie. I love the paranoia that Murphy's displaying later on in this part. And everything on this boat is just tense as hell for me. Did you guys like this part of the film?
I think he's good. I can't really say anything negative about it. But there's an incident that happens on the boat that does kind of not work for me. And I'll save that for a little bit later.
Okay. Jack, did you like all this stuff on the boat with Cillian Murphy getting on it?
I do. I like Cillian Murphy. I like what they do with this character. It's very solid.
We learn that Ferrier is confident that his gas gauge is wrong and that he can fly the channel as instructed. And then the hospital boat ends up getting blown up. And here we see yet more great tension pulled off by Nolan. He was, in fact, nominated for a directing Oscar for this. And man, did he deserve it. This stuff with boat getting bombed, just amazing filmmaking. Soldiers getting crushed in this thing. This is just, God, a coup de grace in filmmaking, I think, is Nolan's work in this. Jack, would you agree with me that this is probably Nolan's best directing job?
Oh, it's a loaded question. I think it might be his most complete. Yeah, there's that one shot when the boat is going down after the torpedo hits it where the camera's mounted on the side, so everything stays in frame. How do I even describe this? The water comes from the left side of the screen as the boat is tipping over, but the camera's mounted on the deck of the boat. So it's like you only see it for 4 or 5 seconds, but it fucks with your head for a second because you're just like, oh, God, that's so claustrophobic. The cinematography is great. Hoyte van Hoytema did this one again. That's a long answer, but I think I agree with you.
Now, Matt, you've been pretty critical of Nolan, especially the past 3 podcasts. How do you think his directing job is in this? Did the anticipation add up for you? Did it pay off?
Gee, thanks for reminding our viewers how much I didn't care for the last 3 movies. I'm going to beat that dead horse, you dick.
That's my job.
Yeah, I've been critical, but I think here, I'm not going to say it's his best directing job because I don't want to go back to movies we've already talked about, but I give him just a little bit more props for, ironically, Batman Begins of all things, just for the task he had to do with all the circumstances of that franchise and all the expectations. But on a technical level, there's really very few things I can criticize in his choices. I think he's a lot more focused. I think he's purposefully doing some unique things, like I said, with the structure. And by relying very little on his scripting, which I think was a huge flaw in his last 3 movies, just letting his camera work and the wizardry do most of the talking is doing wonders for him. It goes to show that I think he's a much stronger director than he is a writer.
Although he's doing both in this, it should be said.
Yeah, he is. But also, you could count how many lines are actually in this movie. It's got to be the least spoken film by a wide margin in his filmography.
Yeah, it can almost pass off as a silent film for me, because the dialogue really doesn't mean much except for what Rana is talking about in the majority of it. But yeah, you're absolutely right. For a guy who's relied so much on expositional dialogue, there's such a small amount of it in this that it was just a bold choice to do. And so far, it's paying off for me. So if there's one thing I heard about a lot in the lead up to this movie. It was the casting of a character in this. It wasn't nearly the toxicity that accompanied Heath Ledger when he was cast as a Joker, but Harry Styles from One Direction was cast in this movie, and everybody was like, what is Nolan thinking? He's doing this again. As it turns out, he's not really in this that much. In fact, I didn't even know which character he played until I looked him up on IMDb. Did you guys like Harry Styles in this? Did he make any bit of impression on you guys whatsoever?
I thought he was fine. He didn't do anything to distract me. So I thought he was fine. I think that he's just as good as any of the other soldiers that he's playing off of. There's nothing that sticks out about him, you know?
There's definitely not a Denise Richards thing going on here. He doesn't do anything to really distract you from the fact that he's playing a good character here.
I think he does what he's asked to do, which is not very much. So I think the backlash was immediately overblown.
Yeah. So Alex, Tommy, and Gibson, they board a destroyer so that they can have a meal and a nice cup of tea. I thought that was kind of funny that the chick's like, have a nice cup of tea. Meanwhile, Cillian Murphy, who is, by the way, he's only credited as the Shivering Soldier. They don't give him a name in the credits here. He wakes up and realizes that Dawson is headed to Dunkirk, and Murphy just doesn't want to head back there for reasons that we'll learn later. Lots of tension created from the door that is locked behind him, and Dawson even says that he's so shell-shocked that he might never be himself again. Again, just Nolan's just ratcheting up the tension here, isn't he, Jack?
Absolutely.
Farrier is shot at by bombers in the air, and then the destroyer, it ends up getting torpedoed. And as somebody who has a major fear of drowning, all this stuff of people struggling underwater is just tough for me to watch, man. This is... Oh, honestly, I had to turn away during this scene. I just can't watch people drown in movies. Another reason I didn't like The Prestige, honestly. I just can't watch people drown. I mean, how do you guys feel about this scene when the boat gets torpedoed and everybody's just struggling underwater?
I mean, it's claustrophobic. What do you say about it? I think it's very well done. It's kind of scary. It's on that vibe of, you know, it's a thriller. It's thrilling to watch.
yeah.
I like it. I definitely like it.
Oh, the claustrophobia just... Oh, God.
If there's two things I hate, it's drowning and claustrophobia. So it was not pleasant to watch by any means, but it's certainly effective.
So Murphy, he ends up getting out of the door that he's locked in and is pessimistic that the pleasure yacht, as he calls it, without any guns that he's on, is going to be any good at rescuing soldiers in Dunkirk. And he insists that they turn the boat around. When they don't, a struggle happens and George is knocked down. Now, Matt, is this the scene you were talking about?
Yeah, this felt so contrived. Of course, one of the innocent characters who's not involved in the war is killed by the soldier suffering from PTSD. It doesn't work for me, like, at all.
I didn't find it cliched. I wasn't expecting it myself. Jack, were you expecting that at all?
No, not really. I was just kind of along for the ride at this point. Wasn't really trying to anticipate anything.
Meanwhile, Collins, he splits from Farrier and he is left alone. We see in a flashback that Murphy did not take the boys on his boat when he had the chance. And it took me a couple of viewings to realize this was indeed a flashback. You know, when we see Murphy on this boat at night and the guys, they come up to it and he's just like, nope, the water's warm enough and you guys are swimming okay, go on the next one. We see that the tide's moving up, as is evident by the bodies that are showing up on shore. And they end up boarding a trawler with some Highlanders as they wait for the rising tide. Meanwhile, we learn that as a result of the struggle with the Shivering Soldier, George cannot see. Matt, this didn't get you at all? Dude, when he says that he's blind, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but anytime a character just reveals that he's blind, he or she is blind, it gets me every time. You really weren't going with this, huh?
No, not particularly, no.
We learn that the French are still holding the perimeter and that they are expecting one destroyer to show up in the morning, which isn't nearly enough to get all the soldiers to safety. More exposition from Bronha's character. Farrier, he's starting to quickly run out of fuel as Dawson finds a minesweeper. All of this is adding up to a tense film for me. How are you guys feeling, boys? We're an hour in. Are you guys feeling the tension in this? Are you guys ready for it all to come together? Matt, are you already feeling this is a 2.5-hour movie, even though it's only not even 100 minutes?
I never felt the length because I don't think this movie is too extraneous whatsoever. I've never checked out whatsoever. And I think Nolan, unlike a lot of his movies prior to this, he doesn't let scenes go on too long. I think the editing's much crisper here than it's been in a while. And he also, he gets the benefit of the doubt by having three separate things to have some interplay with. So it's almost possible to let something linger on too long.
Mm-hmm. I'm not feeling the runtime. I think that this movie's paced very well. So I'm still on board.
literally the cliche of my fingers are ripping onto my chair. That was the first time I was watching this movie for this podcast. Was, as everybody who listens knows, I don't take notes the first time I watch a movie for this show. I literally just sit and watch it. And I was so gripped into the story, I wasn't feeling it at all. Gunshots start penetrating the trawler, and this is where I feel the movie would have worked better if we'd seen the enemy find the boat and then decide to do this. The fact that they're shooting at this trawler, it didn't make any sense to me, and I would like to have seen why they came to this conclusion. I know that's the part of the movie where Nolan takes great pride in. We're not seeing the enemy at all, but this, Jack, you weren't feeling like we needed to see these soldiers go after this boat?
So I'm trying to understand. So you don't understand why they just start firing at this thing?
I would like to see the thought process as to what made them come to this boat and decide to fire on it, yes.
So to me, it's literally they're just shooting targets because they're bored. That was exactly what I thought they were leaning towards. It was just somebody saw a boat was on the shore and just happened to be like, oh, well, soldiers bored at the edge of wherever this perimeter is, just taking pot shots at the ship while they're sitting there. Then once they hear that somebody's inside, that's when they really start opening fire and all that. That's all. I didn't read into it too much more than that.
We see Collins crash his plane in the water and then get rescued by Dawson just in the nick of time. Again, my drowning and claustrophobia fear is coming full circle as he's struggling to breathe and his only hope is to hit the cockpit with his gun until Dawson, who convinced Peter that the pilot might in fact be alive, comes in and pulls him out of the water. Oh boy, this is... Whew. Matt, this must have been tough for you to watch too, right?
I don't get especially squeamish nowadays, but I kind of had to look away at moments. Not because it's, you know, this is not overly violent by any means, but just the fact that you're trapped just makes it worse. Yeah. Oh. It's not just the fact that you're watching it, but you're also in a theater where you can't really move around.
Did you see this on IMAX too? I don't think we talked about that. Did you see this on IMAX?
No, I did not.
Okay. All right. Yeah. See, I saw this on IMAX and you can almost not turn away from an IMAX screen. I had to kind of close my eyes too. The soldiers start plugging the holes caused by the bullets, and here's when Gibson gets accused of being a German spy, hence the mole label. I thought that Nolan did a pretty good job of wordplay with that. The mole does mean the land, but at the same time, it means a spy. Gibson, of course, he denies it, saying that he is actually French and took the soldier he buried's identity, hoping to leave with the English. Matt, I know you kind of get bogged down by melodrama. Was this a little too melodramatic for you? I mean, this is really like the biggest portion of the story here. This is the biggest story we're getting, is this guy's being accused of being a spy. Were you bogged down by this at all?
In a sense, because it kind of comes out of nowhere. It's just an accusation that they make with no real basis on evidence. I get that everyone's paranoid, and it seems like this guy has a fucking GPS on him at all times, so they can always find him. But I think it's just contrived melodrama.
Works well enough for me. It seems like, I think Matt's kind of right there. It's contrived isn't the right word. It's just convenient. It's like, we got to add a little more tension. Can't just be that they're surrounded by the enemy and somebody's shooting at the boat. Can't just be that the boat's now going to drown them all. It also has to be, oh, he's a spy. It's like, okay. But at the same time, it does indicate that there were other countries involved that had just as much to lose here. I mean, that is kind of an important aspect of the story. It's fine for me. It's not the best element of the movie, in my opinion.
That's a great point. You do have to bring up the other countries as well. The soldiers, they start escaping the sinking trawler, but not Gibson, as he gets caught in a chain and drowns. Oil starts leaking into the water, but Bolton tells us that he does indeed see home coming to rescue them as yachts make their way across the water. George ends up dying from his injuries, but this doesn't stop Peter from telling the shivering soldier that he did in fact live. Meanwhile, the oil catches fire, and if I thought drowning was a harrowing fear, imagine how I felt when I saw motherfuckers drown as they were being burnt to death. Jesus Christ. You know, for a PG-13 movie, I did not think this was PG-13, honestly. And even though I have the fucking Blu-ray, I didn't check the rating on this. I thought this was R just because of this scene. So once again, Nolan gets away with a fucking PG-13 rating on a movie that, I don't know, this was a violent scene for me. Matt, did you feel like this was R at all? I mean, I know it's PG-13, but did you feel it was an R-rated movie?
No, mostly because I think he's gotten away with a lot more than most. So I think he gets a certain amount of leeway. But nowadays, this is just it's a modern issue where PG-13 does not mean nowhere near what it used to. And also R can happen much more frequently on stuff that really shouldn't. So I kind of don't pay attention to ratings anymore, to be honest.
Tommy gets on Dawson's boat and Ferrier gives his last dash of heroism as he shoots down the final bomber and glides past the cheering soldiers. Dawson docks as the Shivering Soldier sees George carried away, and they all board a train home. They get handed a blanket by a gentleman who has a very poignant line here. He says, "Well done," to the soldiers. And when one of them says, "All we did was survive," the guy says, "That's enough." How do you guys feel about this, guys? These guys are rescued. They're jumping on this train. This was working for me, especially after just seeing all those guys get burned up in that oil.
Well, I mean, we didn't really talk too much about what makes this movie so unique, though. So, you know, you mentioned up front that the thing that makes this interesting, to me at least, is the way that Nolan makes you experience time from the different perspectives. I mean,
yeah.
One thing that's really cool is when you rewatch this movie, how early on in Tom Hardy's section that you can actually see Mark Rylance's boat before you're, say, even introduced to him. Cillian Murphy is the first moment I remember when I saw the movie opening night where I was just like, oh, wait a minute, something's going on with time here, because you see him on Mark Rylance's boat when you're introduced to him, and then a few scenes later, he's escaping on a lifeboat with a bunch of other soldiers, and he looks like he's in much better shape. His uniform isn't as tattered as we saw it previously. And then that whole scene with the oil and the soldiers burning and all that stuff, that is the moment where all three timelines converge. At the end of the third quarter of the movie, kind of everything lines up, and then it sort of takes you to the conclusion after that. That is what's so cool about this movie for me. That's the thing that I love in this movie more than anything. This didn't have to be the Dunkirk story. It didn't have to be a war movie. Nolan's angle, and we talk about it in all these movies, is he's got some obsession with time and then making films that kind of force you to engage with them in movie form. You know, you couldn't read Dunkirk as a book necessarily and get the same feeling from it. So that's the thing. And I think just generally, that's the thing that I love about Nolan's movies. And when it works phenomenally well. In this, I love that convergence. The music, it's this track called Supermarine on the soundtrack. The one pilot trying to escape from the cockpit while he's just starting to drown in the water. Everything is on the absolute razor's edge of catastrophe. But absolutely love the movie for that. And I feel like before we conclude the story there, you really got to mention that, because that's the thing that elevates this from just being a war movie to being like the work of one of our auteur filmmakers.
I think it changes it from a war movie to an experience, honestly. Exactly.
I think it's a good way to put it. It's an experience, not a story. And I think that's a good approach for a war movie as well, because, you know, like I said earlier, Saving Private Ryan has a clear objective. It's the title of the fucking movie, for goodness sake. But even stuff like Platoon, which kind of has a lot of different through lines. This movie also doesn't have the bombast of that. There's no glorious death scene for any of these characters, which goes to show that, you know, everyone in this war is anonymous. So I like pretty much everything Nolan does here.
We learn that almost 300,000 soldiers had been rescued so far, and that Churchill had finally spoken about the rescue. Now, I love this final bit a lot, because not only is it, I think, as I said, Zimmer's best piece of music in the film, there's actually more tension here. Would the soldiers be welcomed? How would Churchill respond? And Nolan answers these by having one guy pound on the train window. And Tommy thinks that they're trying to threaten him, right? This is citizens rebelling. No, no, no. He's offering them some beer. And instead of showing Churchill give the famous speech, we see the apprehensive Tommy read it from the paper, scared that it was going to insult the soldiers. Instead, he uses it as a rallying cry. Jack, you and I especially, we've talked about it a lot, where Nolan really knows how to conclude these things. And this is working so well for me. God, I love this conclusion. How about you?
I like most of the ending. I love the character reading the newspaper. I love the shots of Tom Hardy's character silently gliding over the beach. At that point, it feels like the only point in the movie where there's very gentle score, things are quiet, and it's jarring. It's like you said, it's that experience thing. The movie takes you on a ride, and I love the sort of ebbs and flows of that. I do have a little problem with the final shot. I think it's a little strange to end it on the kid's face. It doesn't work for me. I would have much rather ended it at the shot of the burning plane and Tom Hardy being taken off. That seems like the better end point for me, but I'm willing to listen to alternative perspectives on that. So,
Well, let me go first, Matt, before you respond. I took that as when he went into it, he was assuming that Churchill was going to downplay it and he was going to insult them for escaping and not necessarily doing anything in the war. That is him realizing that what they had done was important for what was going to happen in the future. That was him realizing that Churchill actually respected what they did instead of downplayed it.
So point one, I agree with Jack that I would have ended it on Tom Hardy getting captured, but I would have juxtaposed that with the Churchill voiceover specifically. I think you could have kept the train part where the soldiers are recognized for what they did. But as Hardy's being taken away, you know, Churchill's voice provides that hope that, much like the soldiers, what Tom Hardy did, because he's presumably going to be murdered by these people, that was also not for nothing. So I think with some minor tweaking, it would have worked a little bit better for me. And I'm also not crazy about the final shot either.
You guys are out of your minds. I was so with both you guys for almost the entire podcast, and you guys pull this shit.
Well, it's just, but think about it this way. The movie is not characterizing these people at all. They're anonymous, right? Yeah. And then to end the movie on a character's face and not have a real reaction from him that I can interpret, right? Whereas in a movie that's about the ride and the experience, if you ended it with the plane burning and that fade to black, that to me is way more in line with the movie that was presented. It just seems like a weird editing mistake at the end of the movie. I don't get it at all. Especially because it fades to black and then it cuts back to the kid's face and then cuts to credits. It's just awkward. Like, yeah. I don't get it.
And when it cuts back that second time, I thought we were going to get like a wall of text explaining the fallout of Dunkirk. But it's this awkward transition. It's almost like one of those fake outs from Return of the King.
Jesus. I thought it was a turning point. I thought it was a realization. You guys are calling it juxtaposition. I don't know. This is right where we disagree. All right. That being said, scale of 1 to 10. Boys, what do we give Dunkirk? Goudreau, sir, you go ahead and go.
So going into this movie, I was ready to finally be won over on Christopher Nolan again. I wanted to like this movie and not have to deal with the fury of a thousand suns and get pitchforks and torches delivered to my house 24/7. So I was happy to report this was a pleasant experience for me, and this is his best movie since The Dark Knight. I know that doesn't sound like high praise coming from me, considering I was very critical of his last three movies, but I think this is one of his... I don't know where it ranks in the pantheon for me, because we got one more movie to go before I do my rankings. But I think for what he set out to do, and that is make a very straightforward war movie that still fits his sensibilities, I think he succeeds at that. Having seen it twice, I'm not sure if this is going to have the rewatchability for me in the way that Batman Begins kind of does for me. Maybe like Batman Begins, I'll develop that more over time as I think about it, but I don't have too many complaints, but despite that, I'm not going to go as high as I did for the cream of the crop movies that I've talked about. So I'm going to land on a very strong 7, largely just because I don't know if I'm ever going to watch this again and if I'm ever going to appreciate it on an emotional level as opposed to strictly a film fan level. Because that's the one thing that I think the best war movies, or the ones that I like the most, I think A Path to Glory, that has a very strong emotional core to it. There's real ethical discussions in that movie. You know, I mentioned All Quiet on the Western Front. Yeah, I really like it, but I'm going to go a really strong 7 on it.
7 out of 10 for Mr. Goudreau. Jack, sir, are you stronger than a 7?
Well, actually, Matt and I agree for once in this retrospective. He said that this is the best movie since The Dark Knight for Nolan. I agree with that. Yeah, I think it is. I love The Dark Knight. I think I love Dunkirk just as much. And I think if I'm picking one movie of Nolan's to show somebody, just to be like, this is what this guy does, I think it's Dunkirk. Honestly, you can go into it. You don't have to have any background. You don't need to bring any baggage. It just works. It's a fucking ride, man. I watch this movie a lot. This is like my go-to movie whenever I have the sound system all to myself. If I'm home alone and I just want to listen to something and just that like adrenaline pumping fucking great scene, I always put on the scene where Supermarine's playing with the oil. I love this movie. Is it an experience more than a movie? I don't really know what that means. This movie entertains me. I go to a Nolan movie, I'm looking for spectacle and blockbuster. That's what I want. I want high class, auteur level filmmaking blockbusters. I think this is the pinnacle of that. So I know it's got a couple issues, but for me, this is one of my absolute favorite movies. This is a 10 on 10. I fucking love Dunkirk.
Wow.
I love the Dark Knight as well. Honestly, I might like this is a difficult line. I love the Dark Knight because I love Batman. I think there's an argument to be made for me that I actually like Dunkirk more than the Dark Knight. So, Yeah, I think this is a phenomenal movie. I do think it'll hold up as a, maybe not as a war movie, but just as like a really cool experiment in time manipulation in a film without like a time travel element. I think it's phenomenal. I think it's a modern classic, and I think it is the standard by which I will be judging future World War II movies.
Wow. I was not expecting a 10 out of 10 on this podcast.
I got to pick my jaw up off the floor.
That really hit me like a Mike Tyson uppercut, I gotta say. Where am I standing on this? Here's the thing. If you had asked me in 2017, and I don't think I was on the BingeCast for any of those Dunkirk shows, I would have said, you know, it was fine. It was up to par. I didn't think it was great. In watching it for this podcast, I will agree with Jack with this much and disagree with you, Matt. I think this has a lot of rewatchability. I think there is something about this movie that gripped me this time when I watched it, both these times. I could not take my eyes off it. I think it is Nolan's coup de grace as a director, as I've mentioned earlier. I think this is his best work as a director. I think this is his cinematographer's best work in the Nolan universe so far. I think this movie's phenomenal. I can't go as high as a 10. I will go 8, though, just because I see myself watching this again. Not only is that a good war movie, not only is it a good job by Nolan, this is an inspiring story, too. This is a set of people who escaped something harrowing. And if you know the history that this was the turning point in the war for the British, it'll inspire you in some way. You know, I saw this movie at a pretty bad time. I was, health-wise, I was pretty low. And watching this, it just inspired me to get better. I just think there are things about this movie that just make me happy. And so, yeah, 8 out of 10 for me. Not quite a 10. One movie left to go, guys. And Jack, I want to give the floor to you because I want you to explain to the people what we're going to be doing with Tenet.
Oh, sure. So the Tenet release has been weird. This whole year has been weird. So I get to thinking, and Garrett and I talked about this, and we just talked to Matt about it as well, that what we're going to do is we're going to record Tenet, but we're going to hold off on releasing it until the home video release. Kupke and I in the binge group, we asked people to abstain from Tenet spoilers just so that everybody had a chance to see it. Not everybody's had a chance to see it yet, you know, whether it's a personal preference of not going to the movie theater yet or literally there not being a theater anywhere near you that is showing the movie. Not everybody's had a fair opportunity to see this thing. So what we're going to do is, since this aftertaste is taking a long time anyways, what's another 8 weeks, right? So we'll record it, we'll put it in the bucket, we'll take it out of the bucket when the fucking movie drops, and you can expect it then. So that's what we're going to do, and hopefully Chad D's okay with that as I'm responding to a text message from him as I speak. So
beautiful. All right, so that'll be Tenet. Guys, I appreciate you guys' patience with me. This has been a long retrospective, longer than I was expecting, but I think it's going to pay off well. I think there are differing opinions on Tenet across the board. And I hear you, Jack. You know, I've been paying attention to the BingeCast. I've been listening to people. There are some people who just can't see it or won't see it because of fear of what's out there right now. So when it gets released on home video, that's when we will go ahead and release that podcast. But while it's still fresh in our minds, I've seen it twice. Jack, I know you've seen it at least twice.
Tenet?
Yeah.
I have not, actually. That's one of the other things, too. Maybe I can get another viewing in before we record, so.
And Matt, how many times have you seen it?
Once. But I think it's appropriate that for a director who is so conscious of using time in his movies that we take our sweet time on this retrospective.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And then, well, hell, since this is the podcast before the next retrospective starts, Jack, should we reveal what we've recorded the last month? Because I think it's going to be a glorious one. I think it's a glorious retrospective, actually. So me, Jack, and Alex got together. We did the three Bill and Ted movies. Yes, we recorded three Bill and Ted podcasts, and they run the gamut of angry to just hysterically laughing. So keep your ears peeled out for those. And then me and Matt, we're going to be getting back together with Mick Duffy, and we're going to be doing Nightmare on Elm Street to cap off our Halloween season. That's going to be our series that we're going to do. I know I started it years ago, never finished it. This time, I'm going to finish it. So me, Matt, and Mick will be doing Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yep, finally, a slasher franchise that I actually like.
That'll be fun to go through. All right, boys. So until next time when we review Tenet, who knows when that'll be. We all need podcasts to remind ourselves of who we are. Thanks, gentlemen.
Where's the box? What box? Everyone has a box. We've managed you for the shoebox.
So valuables, then?
No, more interesting, more personal. Things like snapshots, letters, little trinkets for Christmas.
The Binge Aftertaste is produced by Garrett and Matt.
So you lie to yourself to be happy. There's nothing wrong with that. We all do it. Who cares if there's a few little details you'd rather not remember?
Voice narration done by Adam.
Randy, did you love her?
Sure, she was nice.
She was nice.
Wow.
Well, that makes me all soft inside.
To do was prove that I was a better magician.
Did you get mauled by a tiger?
It was a dog.
Huh?
It was a big dog.
You mustn't be afraid to dream a little bigger, darling.
If I pull that off, will you die?
It would be extremely painful.
You're a big guy.
For you.
The station isn't named after you, sir. It's named after your daughter.
Tide's turning now.
How can you tell?
The body's come back.
We all believe we'd run into the burning building.
Because we have to chase him.
Okay, we're going in! Go, go! Move!
He didn't do anything wrong.
Because he's the hero Gotham deserves. But not the one it needs right now. So we'll hunt him. Because he can take it. Because he's not our hero. He's a silent guardian. A watchful protector. A dark knight.
The two of us, we used to watch all of Jack's favorite director, Oliver Stone's films. We used to watch those a lot.
Woof.
Platoon, Born on the 4th of July.
Those are good ones, because Casualties of War is fucking garbage.
Yeah, Casualties of War isn't that good. I just watched that for the first time, like maybe 6 months ago. And yeah, that's not that good of a film.
Brian De Palma.
I was going to say, yeah, that's De Palma.
I thought for sure it was Oliver Stone.
How'd you feel about this one?
I don't love it, but I don't find it as obtrusive as I have for the last couple of movies. I think, excuse me, I think here it...
All right, boys. So until next time when we review Tenet, who knows when that'll be. Oh my God, I lost my freaking line. It's been so long since I've done it, I lost my line. Here we go. We all need podcasts to remind ourselves of who we are. Thanks, gentlemen.
You've been listening to the Binge Media Podcast Network at BingeMedia.net. Support the show by donating on Patreon at Patreon.com/BingeMedia. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Buy some merch at BingeMedia.net/shop. Subscribe to our newsletter at BingeMedia.net/newsletter. And don't forget...
I didn't stop giving hand jobs because I was good at it. I stopped giving hand jobs because I was the best at it.